towards me. I kept going, pushing my way around corners, stumbling, ducking into openings, trying to get away from their voices. But the exit never came. Everywhere I turned, there was just another expanse of hedge, another mocking voice. I stumbled into an opening, briefly exultant that I was near freedom. But then I saw that I was back at the centre again, back where I had started. I reeled as I saw them all standing there, as if they had simply been waiting for me.
"There you go,"
one of them said, as his hand grabbed my arm.
"I told you she was up for it. Come on, Lulu, give me a kiss and I'll show you the way out."
His voice was soft and drawling.
"Give us all a kiss, and we'll all show you the way out."
Their faces were a blur.
I just want you to... "Come on, Lou. You like me, don't you? You've been sitting on my lap all evening." "One kiss. How hard is that?"
I heard a snigger.
"And you'll show me how to get out?"
My voice sounded pathetic, even to me.
"Just one?"
He moved closer. I felt his mouth on mine, a hand squeezing my thigh. He broke away, and I heard the tenor of his breathing change.
"And now Jake's turn."
I don't know what I said then. Someone had my arm. I heard the laughter, felt a hand in my hair, another mouth on mine, insistent, invasive, and then...
"Will!" I was sobbing now, crouched over myself. "Will!" I was saying his name over and over again, my voice ragged, emerging somewhere from my chest. I heard him somewhere far off beyond the hedge.
"Louisa! Louisa, where are you? What's the matter?"
I was in the corner, as far under the hedge as I could get. Tears blurred my eyes, my arms wrapped tightly around me. I couldn't get out. I would be stuck here forever. Nobody would find me.
"Will! Where are you?"
And there he was, in front of me.
"I'm sorry,"
I said, looking up, my face contorted.
"I'm sorry. I can't do it."
He lifted his arm a couple of inches, the maximum he could manage.
"Oh, Jesus. What the... Come here, Clark."
He moved forward, then glanced down at his arm in frustration.
"Bloody useless thing. It's okay. Just breathe. Come here. Just breathe. Slowly."
I wiped my eyes. At the sight of him, the panic had begun to subside. I stood up unsteadily and tried to straighten my face.
"I'm sorry. I don't know what happened."
"Are you claustrophobic?"
His face, inches from mine, was etched with worry.
"I could see you didn't want to go in. I just thought you were being..."
I shut my eyes.
"I just want to go now."
"Hold on to my hand. We'll go out."
He had me out of there within minutes. He knew the maze backwards, he told me as we walked, his voice calm, reassuring. It had been a challenge for him as a boy to learn his way through. I entwined my fingers with his and felt the warmth of his hand as something comforting. I felt foolish when I realized how close to the entrance I had been all along. We stopped at a bench just outside, and I rummaged in the back of his chair for a tissue. We sat there in silence, me on the end of the bench beside him, both of us waiting for my hiccuping to subside. He sat, sneaking sideways glances at me.
"So?"
he said finally, when I must have looked as if I could speak without falling apart again.
"You want to tell me what's going on?"
I twisted the tissue in my hands. "I can't." He closed his mouth. I swallowed.
"It's not you," I said hurriedly. "I haven't talked to anyone about... It's stupid. And a long time ago, I didn't think I would..."
I felt his eyes on me and wished he wouldn't look. My hands wouldn't stop trembling, and my stomach felt as if it were made of a million knots. I shook my head, trying to tell him that there were things I couldn't say. I wanted to reach for his hand again, but I didn't feel I could. I was conscious of his gaze, could almost hear his unspoken questions. Below us, two cars had pulled up near the gates. Two figures got out. From here it was impossible to see who, and embraced. They stood there for a few minutes, perhaps talking, and then got back into their cars and drove off in the opposite direction. I watched them, but I couldn't think. My mind felt frozen. I didn't know what to say about anything anymore.
"Okay. Here's a thing," he said finally.
I turned around, but he wasn't looking at me.
"I'll tell you something that I never tell anyone.
All right? All right." I screwed the tissue into a ball in my hands, waiting. He took a deep breath.
"I get really, really scared of how this is going to go."
He let that settle in the air between us, and then, in a low, calm voice, he carried on.
"I know most people think living like me is about the worst thing that could happen, but it could get worse. I could end up not being able to breathe by myself, not being able to talk. I could get circulatory problems that mean my limbs have to be amputated. I could be hospitalized indefinitely. This isn't much of a life, Clark, but when I think about how much worse it could get... Some nights I lie in my bed and I can't actually breathe."
He swallowed.
"And you know what? Nobody wants to hear that stuff. Nobody wants you to talk about being afraid or in pain or being scared of dying through some stupid random infection. Nobody wants to know how it feels to know you will never have sex again, never eat food you've made with your own hands again, never hold your own child. Nobody wants to know that sometimes I feel so claustrophobic being in this chair. I just want to scream like a madman at the thought of spending another day in it. My mother is hanging on by a thread and can't forgive me for still loving my father. My sister resents me for the fact that yet again I have overshadowed her, and because my injuries mean she can't properly hate me, like she has since we were children. My father just wants it all to go away. Ultimately, they want to look on the bright side. They need me to look on the bright side."
He paused.
They need to believe there is a bright side.
I blinked into the darkness. Do I do that? I said quietly.
You, Clark. He looked down at his hands. Are the only person I have felt able to talk to since I ended up in this bloody thing.
And so I told him. I reached for his hand. The same one that had led me out of the maze. And I looked straight down at my feet and I took a breath. And I told him about the whole night. And how they had laughed at me and made fun of how drunk and stoned I was. And how I had passed out and later my sister had said it might actually be a good thing than not remembering all of what they had done. But how that half hour of not knowing had haunted me ever since. I filled it, you see. I filled it with their laughter, their bodies and their words. I filled it with my own humiliation. I told him how I saw their faces every time I went anywhere beyond the town, and how Patrick and Mum and Dad and my small life had been just fine for me, with all their problems and limitations. They had let me feel safe. By the time we finished talking, the sky had grown dark, and there were 14 messages on my mobile phone wondering where we were. You don't need me to tell you it wasn't your fault, he said quietly. Above us, the sky had become endless and infinite. I twisted the handkerchief in my hand.
Yes, well, I still feel responsible. I drank too much to show off. I was a terrible flirt. I was...
No. They were responsible.
Nobody had ever said those words aloud to me. Even Trina's look of sympathy had held some mute accusation. Well, if you will get drunk and silly with men you don't know... His fingers squeezed mine. A faint movement, but there it was. Louisa, it wasn't your fault. I cried then. Not sobbing this time. The tears left me silently and told me something else was leaving me. Guilt. Fear. A few other things I hadn't yet found words for. I leant my head gently on his shoulder, and he tilted his head until it rested against mine.
Right. Are you listening to me?
I murmured a yes.
Then I'll tell you something good, he said, and then he waited, as if he wanted to be sure he had my attention. Some mistakes just have greater consequences than others. But you don't have to let that night be the thing that defines you. I felt his head tilt against mine. You, Clark, have the choice not to let that happen. The sigh that left me then was long and shuddering. We sat there in silence, letting his words sink in. I could have stayed there all night, above the rest of the world, the warmth of Will's hand in mine, feeling the worst of myself slowly begin to ebb away. We'd better get back, he said eventually, before they call out a search party. I released his hand and stood, a little reluctantly, feeling the cool breezes on my skin. And then, Almost luxuriously, I stretched my arms high above my head. I let my fingers straighten in the evening air. The tension of weeks, months, perhaps years easing a little, and let out a deep breath. Below me, the lights of the town winked. A circle of light amid the black countryside below us. I turned back towards him. Will? Yes. I could barely see him in the dim light, but I knew he was watching me. Thank you. Thank you for coming to get me. He shook his head and turned his chair back towards the path. To 18. Disneyland is good. I told you, no theme parks. I know you said that, but it's not just roller coasters and whirling teacups. At Florida, you've got the film studios and the science center. It's actually quite educational. I don't think a 35-year-old former company head needs educating. There are disabled loos on every corner, and the members of staff are incredibly caring. Nothing is too much trouble. You're going to say there are rides specially for handicapped people next, aren't you? They accommodate everyone. Why don't you try Florida, Miss Clark? If you don't like it, you could go on to SeaWorld, and the weather is lovely. In Will versus Killer Whale, I think I know who would come off worst. He didn't seem to hear me. And they are one of the top-rated companies for dealing with disability. You know, they do a lot of Make-A-Wish Foundation stuff for people who are dying. He is not dying! I put the phone down on the travel agent just as Will came in. I fumbled with the receiver, trying to set it back in its cradle, and snapped my notepad shut.
Everything all right, Clark?
Fine, I smiled brightly.
Good. Got a nice frock?
What?
What are you doing on Saturday?
He was waiting expectantly. My brain was still stalled on Killer Whale versus travel agent. Nothing. Patrick's away all day training. Why? He waited just a few seconds before he said it, as if it actually gave him some pleasure to surprise me.
We're going to a wedding.
Afterwards, I was never entirely sure why Will changed his mind about Alicia and Rupert's nuptials. I suspected there was probably a large dose of natural contrariness in his decision. Nobody expected him to go, probably least of all Alicia and Rupert themselves. Perhaps it was about finally getting closure. But I think in the last couple of months, she had lost the power to wound him. We decided we could manage without Nathan's help. I called up to make sure the marquee was suitable for Will's wheelchair. And Alicia sounded so flustered when she realised we weren't actually declining the invitation that it dawned on me her embossed correspondence really had been for appearance's sake. Well, there is a very small step up into the marquee. But I suppose the people who are putting it up did say they could provide a ramp. She tailed off. That will be lovely then. Thank you, I said. We'll see you on the day. We went online and picked out a wedding present. Will spent £120 on a silver picture frame, and a vase that he said was absolutely vile for another £60. I was shocked that he would spend that much money on someone he didn't even really like,
But I had worked out within weeks of being employed by the trainers that they had different ideas about money. They wrote four-figure checks without giving it a thought. I had seen Will's bank statement once, when it had been left on the kitchen table for him to look at. It contained enough money to buy our house twice over, and that was only his current account. I decided to wear my red dress, partly because I knew Will liked it, and I figured today he was going to need all the minor boosts he could get, but also because I didn't actually have any other dresses which I felt brave enough to wear at such a gathering. Will had no idea of the fear I felt at the thought of going to a society wedding, let alone as the help. Every time I thought of the braying voices, the assessing glances in our direction, I wanted to spend the day watching Patrick run in circles instead. Perhaps it was shallow of me to even care, but I couldn't help it. The thought of those guests looking down on both of us was already tying my stomach in knots. I didn't say anything to Will, but I was afraid for him. Going to the wedding of an ex seemed a masochistic act at the best of times, but to go to a public gathering, one that would be full of his old friends and work colleagues, to watch her marry his former friend, seemed to me a surefire route to depression. I tried to suggest as much the day before we left, but he brushed it off.
"If I'm not worried about it, Clark, I don't think you should be," he said.
I rang Trina and told her.
"Check his wheelchair for anthrax and ammunition," was all she said. "It's the first time I've got him a proper distance from home, and it's going to be a bloody disaster. Maybe he just wants to remind himself that there are worse things than dying."
Funny. Her mind was only half on our phone call. She was preparing for a week's residential course for potential future business leaders and needed Mum and me to look after Thomas. It was going to be fantastic, she said. Some of the top names in industry would be there. Her tutor had put her forward, and she was the only person on the whole course who didn't have to pay her own fees. I could tell that as she spoke to me, she was also doing something on a computer. I could hear her fingers on the keyboard.
"Nice for you," I said. "It's in some college at Oxford. Not even the ex-poly, the actual Dreaming Spires Oxford."
"Great." She paused for a moment.
"He's not suicidal, is he?"
"Will? No more than usual."
"Well, that's something."
I heard the ping of an email.
"I'd better go, Treen." "Okay, have fun. Oh, and don't wear that red dress. It shows way too much cleavage."
The morning of the wedding dawned bright and balmy, as I had secretly known it would. Girls like Alicia always got their own way. Someone had probably put in a good word with the weather gods.
"That's remarkably bitter of you, Clark," Will said when I told him.
"Yes, well, I've learnt from the best."
Nathan had come early to get Will ready, so that we could leave the house by 9. It was a 2-hour drive, and I had built-in rest stops, planning our route carefully to ensure we had the best facilities available. I got ready in the bathroom, pulling stockings over my newly shaved legs, painting on makeup, and then rubbing it off again in case the posh guests thought I looked like a call girl. I dared not put a scarf around my neck, but I had brought a wrap, which I could use as a shawl if I felt overexposed.
"Not bad, eh?"
Nathan stepped back, and there was Will, in a dark suit and a cornflower blue shirt with a tie. He was clean-shaven and carried a faint tan on his face. The shirt made his eyes look peculiarly vivid. They seemed suddenly to carry a glint of the sun.
"Not bad," I said,
because weirdly I didn't want to say how handsome he actually looked. "She'll certainly be sorry she's marrying that braying bucket of lard anyway." Will raised his eyes heavenwards.
"Nathan, do we have everything in the bag?" "Yep, all set and ready to go."
He turned to Will.
"No snogging the bridesmaids now."
"As if he'd want to," I said. "They'll all be wearing pie crust collars and smell of horse." Will's parents came out to see him off. I suspected they'd just had an argument, as Mrs. Traynor could not have stood further away from her husband unless they had actually been in separate counties. She kept her arms folded firmly, even as I reversed the car for Will to get in. She didn't once look at me.
"Don't get him too drunk, Louisa," she said,
brushing imaginary lint from Will's shoulder.
"Why?"
Will said.
"I'm not driving." "You're quite right, Will," his father said. "I always needed a good stiff drink or two to get through a wedding."
"Even your own," Mrs. Traynor murmured, adding more audibly,
"You look very smart, darling."
She knelt down, adjusting the hem of Will's trousers.
"Really, very smart." "So do you."
Mr. Traynor eyed me approvingly as I stepped out of the driver's seat.
"Very eye-catching. Give us a twirl then, Louisa."
Will turned his chair away.
"She doesn't have time, Dad. Let's get on the road, Clark. I'm guessing it's bad form to wheel yourself in behind the bride."
I climbed back into the car with relief. With Will's chair secured in the back and his smart jacket hung neatly over the passenger's seat so that it wouldn't crease, we set off. I could have told you what Alicia's parents' house would be like even before I got there. In fact, my imagination got it so nearly spot on that Will asked me why I was laughing as I slowed the car. A large Georgian rectory, its tall windows partly obscured by showers of pale wisteria. Its drive a caramel pea shingle. It was the perfect house for a colonel. I could already picture her growing up within it, her hair in two neat blonde plaits as she sat astride her first fat pony on the lawn. Two men in reflective tabards were directing traffic into a field between the house and the church beside it. I wound down the window.
"Is there a car park beside the church?"
"Guests are this way, madam."
"Well, we have a wheelchair and it will sink into the grass here," I said. "We need to be right beside the church. Look, I'll just go there."
They looked at each other and murmured something between themselves. Before they could say anything else, I drove up and parked in the secluded spot beside the church. "And here it starts," I told myself, catching Will's eye in the mirror as I turned off the ignition.
"Chill out, Clark. It's all going to be fine," he said.
"I'm perfectly relaxed. Why would you think I wasn't?"
"You're ridiculously transparent. Plus, you've chewed off four of your fingernails while you've been driving."
I parked, climbed out, adjusted my wrap around myself, and clicked the controls that would lower the ramp.
"Okay," I said, as Will's wheels met the ground.
Across the road from us in the field, people were climbing out of huge Germanic cars, women in fuchsia dresses muttering to their husbands as their heels sank into the grass. They were all leggy and streamlined in pale, muted colours. I fiddled with my hair, wondering if I had put on too much lipstick. I suspected I looked like one of those plastic tomatoes you squeeze ketchup out of. So, how are we playing today? Will followed my line of vision.
Honestly?
Yep, I need to know. And please don't say shock and awe. Are you planning something terrible? Will's eyes met mine. Blue, unfathomable. A small cloud of butterflies landed in my stomach.
We're going to be incredibly well-behaved, Clark.
The butterfly's wings began to beat wildly, as if trapped against my ribcage. I began to speak, but he interrupted me.
Look, we'll just do whatever it takes to make it fun, he said.
Fun? Like going to an ex's wedding could ever be less painful than root canal surgery. But it was Will's choice. Will's day. I took a breath, trying to pull myself together. One exception, I said, adjusting the wrap around my shoulders for the 14th time.
What?
You're not to do the Christy Brown. If you do the Christy Brown, I will drive home and leave you stuck here with the pointy heads.
As Will turned and began making his way towards the church, I thought I heard him murmur,
"Spoil sport."
We sat through the ceremony without incident. Alicia looked as ridiculously beautiful as I had known she would. Her skin polished a pale caramel, the bias-cut off-white silk skimming her slim figure as if it wouldn't dare rest there without permission. I stared at her as she floated down the aisle, wondering how it would feel to be tall and long-legged and look like something most of us only saw in airbrushed posters. I wondered if a team of professionals had done her hair and makeup. I wondered if she was wearing control pants. Of course not. She would be wearing pale wisps of something lacy. Underwear for women who didn't need anything actually supported, and which cost more than my weekly salary. While the vicar droned on, and the little ballet-shod bridesmaids shuffled in their pews, I gazed around me at the other guests. There was barely a woman there who didn't look like she might appear in the pages of a glossy magazine. Their shoes, which matched their outfits to the exact hue, looked as if they had never been worn before. The younger women stood elegantly in 4 or 5 inch heels with perfectly manicured toenails. The older women, in kitten heels, wore structured suits, boxed shoulders with silk linings in contrasting colours, and hats that looked as if they defied gravity. The men were less interesting to look at, but nearly all had that air about them that I could sometimes detect in Will, of wealth and entitlement, a sense that life would settle itself agreeably around you. I wondered about the companies they ran, the worlds they inhabited. I wondered if they noticed people like me, who nannied their children or served them in restaurants, or pole danced for their business colleagues, I thought, remembering my interviews at the job centre. The weddings I went to usually had to separate the bride and groom's families for fear of someone breaching the terms of their parole. Will and I had positioned ourselves at the rear of the church, Will's chair just to the right of my end of the pew. He looked up briefly as Alicia walked down the aisle. But apart from that, he faced straight ahead, his expression unreadable. 48 choristers, I counted, sang something in Latin. Rupert sweated into his penguin suit and raised an eyebrow as if he felt pleased and a bit daft at the same time. Nobody clapped or cheered as they were pronounced man and wife. Rupert looked a bit awkward, dived in towards his bride like somebody apple-bobbing and slightly missed her mouth. I wondered if the upper classes felt it was a bit off to really get stuck in at the altar. And then it was over. Will was already making his way out towards the exit of the church. I watched the back of his head, upright and curiously dignified, and wanted to ask him if it had been a mistake to come. I wanted to ask him if he still had feelings for her. I wanted to tell him that he was too good for that silly caramel woman, no matter what appearances might suggest, and that... oh, I didn't know what else I wanted to say. I just wanted to make it better. "You okay?" I said, as I caught up. The bottom line was, it should have been him. He blinked a couple of times.
"Fine," he said.
He let out a little breath, as if he had been holding it. Then he looked up at me.
"Come on, let's go and get a drink."
The marquee was situated in a walled garden, the wrought iron gateway into it intertwined with garlands of pale pink flowers. The bar, positioned at the far end, was already crowded, so I suggested that Will waited outside while I went and got him a drink. I weaved my way through tables clad in white linen cloths and laden with more cutlery and glassware than I had ever seen. The chairs had gilt backs, like the ones you see at fashion shows, and white lanterns hung above each centerpiece of freesias and lilies. The air was thick with the scent of flowers, to the point where I found it almost stifling.
"Pims,"
the barman said when I got to the front. I looked around, seeing that this was actually the only drink on offer. "Oh, okay, two, please." He smiled at me.
"The other drinks come out later, apparently, but Mr. War wanted everyone to start with Pim's."
The look he gave me was slightly conspiratorial. It told me with the faintest lift of an eyebrow what he thought of that. I stared at the pink lemonade drink. My dad said it was always the richest people who were the tightest, but I was amazed that they wouldn't even start the wedding with alcohol. "I guess that'll have to do then," I said, and took the glasses from him. When I found Will, there was a man talking to him. Young, bespectacled, he was half crouching, one arm resting on the arm of Will's chair. The sun was now high in the sky, and I had to squint to see them properly. I could suddenly see the point of all those wide-brimmed hats.
"So bloody good to see you out again, Will," he was saying. "The office isn't the same without you. I shouldn't say as much, but it's not the same. It just isn't."
He looked like a young accountant, the kind of man who is only really comfortable in a suit.
"It's nice of you to say so."
"It was just so odd, like you fell off a cliff. One day you were there, directing everything. The next we were just supposed to..."
He glanced up as he noticed me standing there.
"Oh,"
he said, and I felt his eyes settle on my chest.
Hello.
Louisa Clark, meet Freddy Derwent. I put Will's glass in his holder and shook the younger man's hand. He adjusted his sight line.
Oh,
he said again.
And?
I'm a friend of Will's, I said, and then not entirely sure why, let my hand rest lightly on Will's shoulder.
Life not all bad, then,
Freddy Derwent said, with a laugh that was a bit like a cough. He flushed a little as he spoke.
Anyway, must mingle. You know these things. Apparently we're meant to see them as a networking opportunity. But good to see you, Will, really. And you, Miss Clark.
He seemed nice, I said, as we moved away. I lifted my hand from Will's shoulder and took a long sip of my Pimm's. It was actually tastier than it looked. I had been slightly alarmed by the presence of cucumber.
Yes, yes, he's a nice kid.
Not too awkward, then?
No.
Will's eyes flickered up to meet mine.
No, Clark. Not too awkward at all.
As if freed by the sight of Freddy Derwent doing so, over the next hour several more people approached Will to say hello. Some stood a little way back from him, as if this absolved them of the handshake dilemma, while others hoisted the knees of their trousers and crouched down almost at his feet. I stood by Will and said little. I watched him stiffen slightly at the approach of two of them. One, a big, bluff man with a cigar, seemed not to know what to say when he was actually there in front of Will, and settled for...
Bloody nice wedding, wasn't it? Thought the bride looked splendid.
I guessed he hadn't known Alicia's romantic history. Another, who seemed to be some business rival of Will's, hit a more diplomatic note. But there was something in his very direct gaze, his straightforward questions about Will's condition, that I could see made Will tense. They were like two dogs circling each other, deciding whether to bare their teeth.
New CEO of my old company,
Will said, as the man finally departed with a wave.
I think he was just making sure that I wouldn't be trying to stage a takeover.
The sun grew fierce. The garden became a fragrant pit. People sheltered under dappled trees. I took Will into the doorway of the marquee, worried about his temperature. Inside the marquee, huge fans had been kicked into life, whirring lazily over our heads. In the distance, under the shelter of a summer house, a string quartet played music. It was like a scene from a film. Alicia, floating around the garden, in ethereal vision, air-kissing and exclaiming, didn't approach us. I watched Will drain two glasses of Pimm's and was secretly glad. Lunch was served at 4 p.m. I thought that was a pretty odd time to serve lunch, but as Will pointed out, it was a wedding. Time seemed to have stretched and become meaningless anyway, its passage blurred by endless drinks and meandering conversations. I don't know if it was the heat or the atmosphere, but by the time we arrived at our table, I felt almost drunk. When I found myself babbling incoherently to the elderly man on my left, I realised it was actually a possibility. "Is there any alcohol in that Pimm's stuff?" I said to Will, after I had managed to tip the contents of the salt cellar into my lap.
"About the same as a glass of wine, in each one,"
I stared at him in horror. Both of him.
You're kidding. It had fruit in it. I thought that meant it was alcohol-free. How am I going to drive you home?
Some carer you are,
he said. He raised an eyebrow.
What's it worth for me not to tell my mother?
I was stunned by Will's reaction to the whole day. I had thought I was going to get taciturn Will, sarcastic Will, at the very least, silent Will. But he had been charming to everybody. Even the arrival of soup at lunch didn't faze him. He just asked politely whether anybody would like to swap his soup for their bread, and the two girls on the far side of the table, who professed themselves wheat intolerant, nearly threw their rolls at him. The more anxious I grew about how I was going to sober up, the more upbeat and carefree Will became. The elderly woman on his right turned out to be a former MP who had campaigned on the rights of the disabled, and she was one of the few people I had seen talk to Will without the slightest discomfort. At one point I watched her feed him a slice of roulade. When she briefly got up to leave the table, he muttered that she had once climbed Kilimanjaro.
I love old birds like that, he said. I could just picture her with a mule and a pack of sandwiches, tough as old boots.
I was less fortunate with the man on my left. He took about 4 minutes, the briefest of quizzes about who I was, where I lived, who I knew there, to work out that there was nothing I had to say that might be of interest to him. He turned back to the woman on his left, leaving me to plough silently through what remained of my lunch. At one point, when I started to feel properly awkward, I felt Will's arm slide off the chair beside me, and his hand landed on my arm. I glanced up, and he winked at me. I took his hand and squeezed it, grateful that he could see it. And then he moved his chair back 6 inches and brought me into the conversation with Mary Rawlinson.
So, Will tells me you're in charge of him, she said. She had piercing blue eyes and wrinkles that told of a life impervious to skincare routines.
I try, I said, glancing at him.
And have you always worked in this field?
No, I used to work in a cafe. I'm not sure I would have told anybody else at this wedding that fact, but Mary Rawlinson nodded approvingly.
I always thought that might be rather an interesting job, if you like people and are rather nosy, which I am, she beamed.
Will moved his arm back onto his chair.
I'm trying to encourage Louisa to do something else, to widen her horizons a bit.
What did you have in mind? She asked me.
She doesn't know, Will said. Louisa is one of the smartest people I know, but I can't make her see her own possibilities.
Mary Rawlinson gave him a sharp look.
Don't patronise her, dear. She's quite capable of answering for herself.
I blinked.
I rather think that you, of all people, should know that, she added.
Will looked as if he were about to say something, and then closed his mouth. He stared at the table and shook his head a little, but he was smiling.
Well, Louisa, I imagine your job at the moment takes up an awful lot of mental energy, and I don't suppose this young man is the easiest of clients.
You can say that again.
But Will is quite right about seeing possibilities. Here's my card. I'm on the board of a charitable organisation that encourages retraining. Perhaps you would like to consider something different in the future. I'm very happy working with Will, thank you. I took the card that she proffered regardless, a little stunned that this woman would have the slightest interest in what I did with my life. But even as I took it, I felt like an imposter. There was no way I would be able to give up work, even if I knew what I wanted to learn. I wasn't convinced I was the kind of person who would suit retraining. And besides, keeping Will alive was my priority. I was so lost in my thoughts that I briefly stopped listening to the two of them beside me. It's very good that you've got over the hump, so to speak. I know it can be crushing to have to readjust your life so dramatically around new expectations. I stared at the remains of my poached salmon. I had never heard anyone speak to Will like that. He frowned at the table and then turned back to her.
I'm not sure I am over the hump, he said quietly.
She eyed him for a moment and glanced over at me. I wondered if my face betrayed me.
Everything takes time, Will, she said, placing her hand briefly on his arm. And that's something that your generation find it a lot harder to adjust to. You have all grown up expecting things to go your way almost instantaneously. You all expect to live the lives you chose, especially a successful young man like yourself. But it takes time.
Mrs. Rawlinson, Mary, I'm not expecting to recover, he said.
I'm not talking about physically, she said. I'm talking about learning to embrace a new life.
And then, just as I waited to hear what Will was going to say next, there was a loud tapping of a spoon on a glass, and the room hushed for the speeches. I barely heard what they said. It seemed to me to be one puffed-up penguin-suited man after another, referring to people and places I didn't know, provoking polite laughter. I sat and chewed my way through the dark chocolate truffles that had arrived in silver baskets on the table, and drank 3 cups of coffee in quick succession, so that as well as feeling drunk, I felt jittery and wired. Will, on the other hand, was a picture of stillness. He sat and watched the guests applaud his ex-girlfriend, and listened to Rupert drone on about what a perfectly wonderful woman she was. Nobody acknowledged him. I don't know if that was because they wanted to spare his feelings, or because his presence there was actually a bit of an embarrassment. Occasionally, Mary Rawlinson leant in and muttered something into his ear, and he nodded slightly, as if in agreement. When the speeches finally ended, an army of staff appeared and began clearing the centre of the room for dancing. Will leant into me.
Mary reminded me there is a very good hotel up the road. Ring them and see if we can stay there.
What? Mary handed me a name and a telephone number scribbled on a napkin.
It's okay, Clark, he said quietly, so that she couldn't hear. I'll pay. Go on, and then you can stop worrying about how much you've drunk. Grab my credit card from my bag. They'll probably want to take the number.
I took it, reached for my mobile phone, and walked off into the further reaches of the garden. They had 2 rooms available, they said, a single and a double on the ground floor.
Yes, it was suitable for disabled access.
Perfect, I said, and then had to swallow a small yelp when they told me the price. I gave them Will's credit card number, feeling slightly sick as I read the numbers.
So?
He said when I reappeared. I've done it, but...
I told him how much the two rooms had come to.
That's fine, he said. Now, ring that bloke of yours to tell him you're staying out all night. Then have another drink. In fact, have six. It would please me no end to see you get hammered on Alicia's father's bill.
And so I did. Something happened that evening. The lights dropped, so that our little table was less conspicuous. The overpowering fragrance of the flowers was tempered by the evening breezes, and the music and the wine and the dancing meant that in the most unlikely of places, we all began to actually enjoy ourselves. Will was the most relaxed I had seen him. Sandwiched between me and Mary, he talked and smiled at her, and there was something about the sight of him being briefly happy that repelled those people who might otherwise have looked at him askance or offered pitying glances. He made me lose my wrap and sit up straight. I took off his jacket and loosened his tie, and we both tried not to giggle at the sight of the dancing. I cannot tell you how much better I felt once I saw the way posh people danced. The men looked as if they had been electrocuted. The women did little pointy fingers at the stars and looked horribly self-conscious even as they twirled. Mary Rawlinson muttered, "Dear God," several times. She glanced over at me. Her language had got fruitier with every drink.
You don't want to go and stretch your stuff, Louisa?
God, no. Jolly sensible of you. I've seen better dancing at a bloody young farmers' club disco. At 9, I got a text from Nathan.
All okay?
Yes. Lovely, believe it or not. Will having great time. And he was. I watched him laughing hard at something Mary had said. And something in me grew strange and tight. This had shown me it could work. He could be happy if surrounded by the right people, if allowed to be Will. Instead of the man in the wheelchair, the list of symptoms, the object of pity. And then, at 10 p.m, the slow dances began. We watched Rupert wheel Alicia around the dance floor, applauded politely by onlookers. Her hair had begun to droop, and she wrapped her arms around his neck as if she needed the support. Rupert's arms linked around her, resting on the small of her back. Beautiful and wealthy as she was, I felt a little sorry for her. I thought she probably wouldn't realise what she had lost until it was much too late. Halfway through the song, other couples joined them, so that they were partially obscured from view. And I got distracted by Mary talk about carers' allowances, until suddenly I looked up, and there she was, standing right in front of us, the supermodel in her white silk dress. My heart lodged in my throat. Alicia nodded a greeting to Mary, and dipped a little from her waist, so that Will could hear her over the music. Her face was a little tense, as if she had had to prime herself to come over.
Thank you for coming, Will. Really.
She glanced sideways at me, but said nothing.
"Pleasure,"
Will said smoothly.